Let's welcome Mr. Joe Dante. Joe, thank you so much for coming on The Crooks and Liars.
Yeah, it's good to be here, John.
Man, what a great flick. You know, the question I wanted to start with, you know, for myself, I've been a huge horror and sci-fi fan from when I was a little kid, and the first movie that I remember seeing was the 1951 classic The Thing with James Arnaz, and that got me into this whole genre. It's been a lifelong love of mine. What was there a particular movie or an instance that got you into this whole genre?
For me, it was I saw It Came from Outer Space in 3D, and it was previously I had only gone to the movies for Saturday matinees for 10 cartoons, and when the pictures came on, I left because it was full of adults and I wasn't interested. And so one day I stayed, and it was It Came from Outer Space, and it was a revelation, needless to say. And I realized that even though these pictures had girls in them, they were still pretty much worth watching. And so I was lucky at that time in New Jersey. There was they would revive a lot of old pictures on double bills for Saturday matinees, and so you'd go in, and it was like a quarter to get in, and the first boy and girl in line got in free. So everybody'd line up for like 2 or 3 hours before it started so they could be the first kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, candy was a nickel. Popcorn was a dime. I mean, it was a long time ago. Boy, I'm dating myself. But it was a lot of fun, and I got the habit. I just got the movie habit, and particularly the scary movie habit, even though I would, like all kids, I'd come home and I'd have nightmares, and my parents would go, you can't go to see any of the more of those movies. You're ruining your life. And what's worse, they're ruining our life. But, you know, when you go see a movie like Them, which had giant ants in it, and they made this cricket-like noise that was very similar to the noises that came out of my backyard, you know, you couldn't help but, you know, imagine that these things were rapping on your window at night, even if it was just a tree branch.
Do you remember Chilla Theater?
Well, there were a lot of different theaters. So I remember Shock Theater. That was the one that was in the New York, New Jersey area in the late 50s. And they ran all the Universal stuff. But there was, you know, over the years, from the 60s and 70s and 80s, there was all these chiller theater type shows. There was one that had a particularly memorable opening with some sort of claymation hand that came up out of the ground or something, and that was syndicated, I think, to a lot of different places. And so, you know, all us monster kids would, you know, end up actually having a lot of the same memories, even if we didn't live in the same areas.
Right, I know. That was with Chiller, and you'd have like these old Peter Graves 50s movies. It's always like some kind of giant bug.
Well, all metaphors. All metaphors for atomic power.
Maybe Tom DeLay? I don't know.
But we learned our lessons good. You know, those 50s pictures had a lot of political content in there, even though they didn't know.
Really, one of the first men, maybe the first person to make a movie about what's happening today. Was this a real...
Isn't that a sad commentary?
It is a sad commentary.
I mean, if you think about it, I mean, you know, this is a series. To give you a little background, I mean, this series is called Masters of Horror. And it's 13 one-hour horror movie episodes directed by people who have done them before. And the gimmick was that, you know, since they didn't have a lot of time or money to give us, they said, well, you know, we'll let you do whatever you want. You know, you have creative freedom. You guys can choose the stories you want to do. And as long as it can be produced, you know, responsibly and under these circumstances, you know, you can do it. So for me, it was like, well, you know, I mean, initially I found a bunch of stories that I thought had been, you know, kind of overlooked that I thought would be good, but we couldn't get the rights to them. And then I was just sort of thinking, well, wait a minute. I mean, this is really actually kind of an opportunity. I mean, I really shouldn't just go off and do some sort of vampire slasher thing. I should try to use this opportunity because the fact that the cable company doesn't have any input into the content of the shows and the fact that they're going to be released on DVD afterward with no interference from anybody, I could probably get away with something on this series that I probably wouldn't be able to get produced anywhere else. So Sam Hamm, who's a friend of mine, he wrote Batman, and he and I are kind of political, and we do a lot of, you know, blogging, going from blog to blog and stuff and sending stuff around. And we got to thinking, you know, I mean, this administration has been in power since, you know, the year 2000, under somewhat shady circumstances, I would say. But and yet, as we sat back and watched, you know, what their destructive activities over the past 6 years, you know, very few people have actually said anything about it. I mean, it's really a pretty big story. I mean, it's the transformation of American society, and not by mandate, by the way. And
right.
right. Yet nobody was really doing anything about it. Everybody was sort of just not dealing with it. And it seemed to me that this would be an opportunity to sort of try to collect all of our various gripes about what's been going on and try to put them into one, you know, hour-long story that would, you know, hit a lot of the points that we've all been making and thinking for the past couple of years and, you know, make a point, obviously. And so Sam found a short story by a guy named Dale Bailey in Fantasy and Science Fiction, which has the broad outlines of the same story that we did, except the difference is that our story is set during a presidential election, and the original story is a gun control story about people who have been killed with guns who come back. And so we decided to change it to, you know, what would happen if people who went to Iraq who didn't think it was a good idea and they got killed there as soldiers had the chance to come back and try to vote out the people who sent them there.
You know what's brilliant, too, about it, which is, you know, normally zombie movies, it's like they come back and they're mindless and they want to just eat people. And when I saw that the zombies came back, but they actually talked and they had a purpose, it turned the whole genre on its head.
Well, it's an interesting genre because, you know, for years zombie movies were, you know, pretty disreputable. I mean, the zombie movies from the 30s and 40s were based entirely on voodoo ideas, and they took place mostly in the West Indies, or they were at least West Indies-type zombies. And it was never an exalted genre. I mean, from the days of White Zombie, which was a big hit movie, but was actually considered kind of a, you know, below-par product. The only one that really had any quality that was noticed was I Walk with a Zombie, the Val Lewton picture, which is still a very poetic and interesting picture and just came out on DVD. But then, you know, as you go through the 50s, you get Zombies of Moritau and Zombies of the Stratosphere, and the whole zombie concept is kind of silly. That continued through the mid-60s with pictures like I Eat Your Skin, which is another zombie, you know, Caribbean movie. But then, you know, George Romero made Night of the Living Dead, which is not strictly a zombie movie. It's a Living Dead movie. But the appellation zombies started to apply to this picture. And all of a sudden, zombies now stood for anybody who comes back from the dead. It doesn't have to be, you know, West Indians. The whole voodoo angle just sort of disappeared from it, with very rare exceptions. I mean, like the Serpent and the Rainbow and some others. But for the most part, that aspect of zombiedom has been abandoned, and it's now through, you know, the countless imitations of George's movies and the sequels that George did, and all the Italian movies, and, you know, the flesh-eating, gut-munching, you know, Fulci kind of movies. The idea of a zombie now is a guy who, you know, comes back from the grave and eats your head. So that wasn't, we were kind of trying to do a spin on that, because the obvious perception would be, well, when these people come back from the grave, they're standard monsters. And of course the reverse is that the monsters in our picture are the human people, and the monsters are really the good guys.
You're the first guy to actually show caskets with, you know, with our flags, right? Because obviously the administration has tried so hard not to let people see that imagery.
I mean, it is a powerful image, and it's powerful in ways that are too complex to go into here. And plus, there are a huge number of people who have lost loved ones in the war, and, you know, it's extremely difficult to tell this story without offending those people, because it's a bad taste subject. There's no doubt about it, and the movie is, you know, I'm afraid in bad taste. There's no doubt about it, because the subject that it's about is an even worse taste. And you know, there was some concern on my part, and maybe nobody else's, about, you know, the way that these scenes were going to play out. But it seemed to me that the imagery was so powerful that there was no getting around it. I mean, this was the basic, you know, thrust of the story, and that if you didn't have this scene, you would really kind of be dancing around the edges of your story. I mean, you really need this scene. It's because of the images. It's pretty powerful.
No, it really was. I mean, without that, it would have been cheap. And the horror of the movie doesn't really come from the characters, but it comes from the Republican Party and what they're doing to the country.
Well,
that was
a
conscious
really
effort,
a horror
really.
Movie. I mean, it's not. A lot of the fans on the net have, like, complained, well, you know, it isn't much of a horror movie, and I agree. It's not. particularly scary, and it doesn't, you know, follow a lot of the genre conventions. But the horrific aspect is just the story itself, and because the story we're all living. I mean, we're in this movie. You know, this movie is happening to us. And I never mentioned, you know, any parties in the picture. And we never mentioned who's running, and it's supposed to be sort of taking place in 2008, although that doesn't really make much sense because the current administration, the president wouldn't be running then. But in order to make the point, it seemed like you couldn't set it in the last election because we all know, you know, what happened there, or at least those of us who will admit what happened there. And so it was better to sort of put it in this kind of limbo situation where, you know, everybody is identifiable but not necessarily identified.
What's your point of view on the media? Because you obviously take shots at it.
Well, my point of view on the media is that until Hurricane Katrina, I mean, we might as well not have had a media. I mean, nobody said anything. Nobody did anything. Nobody questioned anything. The New York Times didn't question anything. I mean, people just, they printed the handouts. They sat by and they watched stage-managed speeches with supposed town halls with all pre-selected people with scripted lines, you know, and we saw that passed off as reality. And I didn't see a lot of media commentators complaining about it, which I don't get. I mean, I just don't get it. Has there ever been a more secretive administration? I mean, even Nixon?
Who, never.
You know, we look back at with fondness now. At, you know, I mean, everything that's happened has either happened behind closed doors or has been phonied up. And for a long time, until they really spectacularly imploded with Katrina, nobody really said anything about it. I mean, finally, people, the incompetence that has hallmarked this administration since the beginning finally started falling over itself pell-mell until reporters in the field even were moved to comment on how screwed up everything was.
Right, they couldn't get away from that imagery, and they tried it, and then they just looked more foolish with Chertoff coming on and, you know, FEMA Brown. And
no, it's just that, you know, you couldn't, it's almost like it had to happen. I mean, so many things have been bungled by these people that sooner or later it seemed like it had to catch up with them. And it has, but, you know, nonetheless, I mean, you can't count them out. I mean, these people are—they're very insidious, and they're not stupid, and they know how to manipulate things, and they will do whatever they can do. In my view, well, it's not exactly a mainstream phenomenon. This film. I mean, you know, it's on a cable network, which is a niche network. You have to be a subscriber to get it. It's in a genre that is generally derided, and people don't really take seriously anyway. I think you're likely to see any columns by Frank Rich or Bill O'Reilly about it. You know, I mean, this is not going to happen. But it does have, I think, a sort of an underground following of people who, and an underground following of people who hate it as well. And you can see that on blogs. You can see that in reactions. If you go to the Ain't It Cool site, which is probably not the last word in sophisticated reactions to movies. There's usually some sort of diatribe by some specific person who hasn't seen the whole show or tuned it out after 10 minutes, and then goes on a political rant about, you know, why everybody who agrees with whatever it says is crazy, and they tend to dominate the discussion,
mm-hmm.
And I find that to be true on a lot of the right wing blogs as well. When I grew up, it wasn't a bad word to be a Republican. It's like there were two parties in the country, and they had differing ideas of how to govern the country, but there was no feeling that one of them, you know, didn't like the country just because they disagreed. And I think the successful demonization of anybody who disagrees with this group of people is really their biggest achievement. Because, as you say, people are afraid to speak out and say anything for you know, fear of being branded a traitor. I mean, who was it that called for Howard Dean to be hung the other day?
Right, that was Michael Regan.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, that's another phenomenon. I mean, the rise of right-wing talk radio in the 80s and 90s really set a tone of for our lack of discourse. And people say, well, you know, America, liberals can't have good radio because they're not angry enough, you know. And that's true, I guess, because they're not angry all the time, like the right-wing guys are. But, I mean, but we are angry. I mean, we have a lot to be angry about. I mean, when you sit back and you watch the country you grew up in change into something that, you know, resembles a country that you were taught, you know, that we didn't want to be anything like, it's a cause for some, you know, anger, especially when it seems to be, you know, being forced down everybody's throats and nobody's saying anything about it.
No, Ronald Reagan deregulated radio. It's sort of, and with Rush Limbaugh, it's sort of opened up
that fairness doctrine.
Right. And so then everything went out the window. And so you have, you know, blocks of Rush and then Hannity and Michael Savage. So it's nonstop.
Well, it is nonstop. And there are stations that do nothing but run one show after another. And these guys, you know, obviously they have to fill their time. They have to rant. They have to be make the, you know, have to play to their base, and so they've run out of things to say. So now they're doing this anti-Christmas rant. You know, I mean, which is the most ludicrous, you know, thing to have to be upset about that I've ever heard of. I mean, it's like, okay, so they say Happy Holidays. So what? You say Happy Holidays or you say Merry Christmas. Some people aren't Christians. Some people are Christians and don't celebrate Christmas. You know, do they have to be? You know, can't they say whatever they want? Nobody's saying that you can't say Merry Christmas or run a Christmas carol or have a Christmas tree or, you know, but this phony issue that's been dredged up by people like O'Reilly, you know, so that they can sell more books and get more people to tune into their show so they can listen to them, you know, dump on, you know, poor people like Jews who, you know, how dare they not be Christians? Who they think they are? You know, I mean, it's like unbelievable.
It's really all about generating money.
Yeah, it is, and it's you know, I mean, the obscenity of some of the stuff that passes for supposed programming, and I don't mean, you know, sexy programming. Fox News, it is a brilliant concept. You have to give it to them. I mean, they came on with a new kind of station with lots of graphics and lots of music and lots of fast cutting and all this kind of stuff. And there's no doubt about it. I mean, it made the other shows look dull. And I think that was a big part of its appeal. But also the idea that they're going to be toting the party line and that they're going to be, you know, have an agenda to their news so that, you know, everything is skewed a certain way is, you know, it's kind of, it's brand new in journalism as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I remember you were supposed to be, try to be impartial. But the myth of the liberal media is, you know, I just can't believe anybody's falling for this now. And that's what I've gotten, you know, on Homecoming. We've gotten a lot of the, well, this is the same kind of liberal media crap that we get all the time, and we're sick of it, and it's like, excuse me, you didn't never got it. I mean, you don't get it anywhere. You haven't gotten it for the last 6 years for sure.
You have sort of a Cindy Sheehan-type character, and I read where, you know, that wasn't planned. It was inevitable that something like that would happen, and just explain how that came about.
Well, you know, we wrote the story, and there had already been a Cindy Sheehan-like character who got a lot of attention in Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11.
Oh, yes.
In fact, she actually looks physically somewhat like the actress that we cast. And that was a very moving part of that movie. I'm sure that in the back of our heads, we, you know, for every soldier that dies, there's got to be a grieving mother. So it was, you know, it's just de rigueur that we would put that into the story. What we didn't realize was that at the same time we were doing that, that the real Cindy Sheehan was now about to come out of her obscurity and become a symbol. And so when it finally went on the air, people went, oh, look, they did the Cindy Sheehan thing. And it's like, well, yeah, we did, but we didn't realize it was her.
Right. I mean, it was going to happen. I mean, and the fact that the attack that she received, it was just obscene. I mean, completely obscene, and you did treat it. But I think in the movie, I think you actually had the producers. They cut away from her when she was talking, which is what.
Well, no, they just she started. They're not when she starts talking, and they just go to the commercial, and the music comes up. But they do that. I've seen them do that on these shows.
Yeah, no, you were really accurate, and also it was interesting. Is what started the whole zombie phenomenon was a wish that the Republican, it seemed like he had, well, we'll call him a Republican, but it seemed like he had sort of a moment of a real choice, and he was really moved for a second, and that was the event or the wish that started the whole movie.
Right, and I think part of that comes from his you know, deep dark secret in his past, which even he doesn't cop to. And that's why when people say, well, geez, all the characters in the movie are Republicans and you hate them all, I said, well, it's not true. I mean, this guy is presented as that rare bird, a Republican with a conscience, you know, and he actually does undergo a transformation during the movie. And so I don't think it's a blanket condemnation of Republicans. It's an attempt to get back at the people in power. It's an authoritarian movie. And the people who are in power and doing this to us happen right now to be Republicans.
Yeah, we could thank Karl Rove for that, because there are so many. Well, I have a lot of Republican friends, and they're just great people. I need to be more clear sometimes, but on my blog I'm very clear.
Well, but you know, it's hard to be clear now, because the lines by the far right have been drawn so clearly that, you know, they have co-opted. They've co-opted an entire party. I mean, the entire party has been moved so far to the right that you don't recognize some of the people in it. And if I was a moderate Republican, I would be extremely uncomfortable, you know, being lumped in with the crazies who are, and the neocons, and the people who want to remake the world that, you know, to look like they think it should look. That would really disturb me. I mean, I would think about becoming independent rather than have to be responsible for you know, the things that some of these guys say. If you or I did our job as bad as Don Rumsfeld does his job, would we still be working? No. The fact that this guy, who is borderline nuts, is actually still the Secretary of Defense of this country, and who recently went out on in front of a podium and was corrected by his own general. I don't know. I mean, I see these guys, and I just get that sort of deja vu about the opening of Fahrenheit 9/11, which is, I think, the first 10 minutes of that movie are absolutely brilliant. Where he says, "It just seemed like a bad dream. This couldn't be true. This can't actually have happened."
With Wolf Woods like licking his comb and stuff. Oh my God. That was just too much, and you know, he got vilified, and
well, but he not only got vilified. I mean, first of all, you got to remember this movie was a gigantic hit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of people saw it. A lot of people saw it overseas, and but the spin machine since then has managed to try to. It's pretty much perceived now as a pack of lies, and I just happened to see it again the other night because they ran it ahead of the premiere of Homecoming. In a brilliant programming move. And, you know, it's just as powerful, if not more powerful today, than it was when it was released. Because now we know more than we did when we saw it before. And it hasn't been invalidated. I mean, virtually everything that it says has been validated, except for some stuff about who left, which Bin Laden family member left on what plane at what point, you know. But the rest of it, I don't.
I don't want to keep you on anymore. You know, we've been going for a long while, and thank you so much
for
joining me. It was great, and
I'll be clicking on now and again to see what's up.
No problem, and we will talk real soon, Mr. Joe Dante. Thank you very much. Go and see Homecoming.
Okay.